Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 34 of A Year-Long Conversation. Today, we are concluding our Sacred Cows trilogy, and we're also going to be talking about, do we really need a revolution? We're going to get into the different political movements, and we're also going to talk about the myth of third parties. Do America really even need a third party? Joining me, as always, Blue in Alabama's Michael. Michael, how's it going? Are you sad to see our Sacred Cows trilogy end?
I am, but, you know, speaking of revolutions, I'm glad we are revolutionizing the podcast.
I know. It's just too bad no one notices. But we have one trilogy left now that we're in the final two-thirds. We finished two-thirds of our podcast, and we're in the final third. Look at how the time flies. I mean, can you believe that we're already two-thirds of the way done?
I know. I can't believe it. It feels like just yesterday.
We were talking about stuff that it'd be fun to do. Me, you mentioned we should have one episode that would just be like a blooper reel, where we just have like all these bloopers and stuff. I mean, in our case, we'll be recording, and somebody will literally just come walking through the room. Somebody just come wandering in through the room, and I was watching the show Marin, where Mark Marin has a garage to film his podcast. I was like, man, I'd kill somebody for a garage right about now. You get that full bastard Marin over there with a full garage to himself making these podcasts and everything. I'm like, that full rotten with that full garage to himself. Knowing what you know now, and we're starting, what would it either be nice to have, or what would you do differently?
A central location. Somewhere we could do this face-to-face.
Yeah.
And some microphones.
Yeah. So microphones would be my thing. People sometimes, when I read the reviews, our reviews are really good, really positive. We have not that many fans, but our fans are passionate. They like what we do, which I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I love hearing about our fans. But sometimes I hear some of them be like, there's some technical glitches and like the sound's not quite as good as it should be. And I'm like, that's true. But you did see where we don't have sponsors. did see at the beginning if it could be like, we'd like to thank you to Gary's Adult Diapers for all their support over the years or whatever. Like if we had even one or two, well, it's kind of nice that we don't, because then we could talk about whatever we want to talk about, which is what makes me think about Sacred Cows. So in the very first episode of this trilogy, we talked about constitutionalists and how they might be barking at the wrong tree, and really we're long overdue for a constitutional convention, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon, but we're long overdue for one. And the second one, we talked about Islam. I already heard chatter. One thing that keeps coming up, and I meant to address it then, but it's happened since I told people, like, well, we're going to do an episode about Islam, we're going to talk about it, we're going to get into it. Somebody was like, well, you know, Christians back in the 16th century, they were killing each other left and right. Every time somebody says that, I literally, even if I'm on the phone and even if I'm online talking to somebody through like a message board or something, I look over my shoulder to see if there's a Christian behind me that they're talking to. Because, I mean, I'm not a Christian, so like it has nothing. I'm like, hey, you want to put them down? Go ahead. The Catholic Church is one of the most corrupt institutions that's ever existed. I mean, the Catholic Church ran a sex trafficking ring for 100 years and for hundreds of years got away with it. Former Pope Benedict should have been tried on a RICO charge for masterminding this sex trafficking ring.
Yeah.
I'm not a Christian. So when people throw that defense out there, I'm like, that seems more like a put-down of Christianity than anything of a defense of Islam, frankly. That doesn't seem like a credible, it's not a credible defense, and it's kind of a third-grade defense where it would be like, oh, Muhammad, you just punched Jimmy. 2 weeks ago, Jimmy beat up another kid that had nothing to do with me. Oh, like if you're in the sixth grade, you can get away with, they did the same thing 5 weeks ago. You can't really make a defense out of that. Like, talking about what another religion did like 400 years ago is a pretty lousy defense. But I get that defense a lot. And most of the defenses of Islam center around put-downs of Christianity. Yeah, you go ahead and do that, because that's what I've been saying, too. I've been saying that, too, that it can go as well. Points people make, like, oh, well, in the Arab world, all these things like algebra and agriculture, all this stuff started there. And I'm like, yeah, pre-Islam. So that's a slam against Islam. Yeah, but Christianity had this period of violence. I'm like, yeah, so we should get rid of both of them. Well, I don't necessarily mean that either. And they're kind of making my points for me a lot of times. We're now in the middle of like taking down every other ideology. We've kind of done constitutionalism, and we've kind of done religion. They also play into this, because when we talk about revolutions, you kind of see that like things are not really ever going to be like that different or change that much. When I ask people, I'm like, well, what would you want to see happen with Islam? They'll be like, oh, I like what Malala is doing. I like what she's doing. And to me, and I know people will say it's easy for me to say this, like I've seen the movie He Named Me Malala, and I've seen her a lot and stuff, and she's great. I'm not trying to put her down at all. But I was the part in the movie where the documentarian said, what would you do if you told your parents that you wanted a date. And she, her face froze. She's like, oh my God, a date? I'm like, well, yeah. Your brother has a girlfriend. Why can you not have a boyfriend? And she was like, it was really awkward. It was like somebody farted in the room or something. And then even when she's on the computer, she's like, I like this soccer player. He's a good one. They're like, oh, what about Brad Pitt? Because up there trying to figure out her feelings towards boys. And they asked her, they said, well, what would you do if you wanted to have a brother? Well, I think my parents would be so shocked. They would just be so surprised, and it was all a dodge around it. So I think when you look at Malala, and she's somebody who still wears the headscarf, she still doesn't really feel comfortable going out on dates. She's like completely asexual, even though she's a teenager. She's not a child, basically. They kind of treat her as a child when it comes to sex and relationship and matters like that. So even though she's a revolutionary, and to a lot of like people in the Muslim world, like she's a heretic and must be killed and blasphemous. If she were in our society and culture, she'd be the biggest square there is. She'd be more religious than most. You know, she'd be a church girl in America and everything. And so what she's saying is very, very mild. It's basically girls should get an education. And I love how it's like, Malala's a revolutionary. She's a far liberal. And all she's saying is girls should get an education. Shoot her! Kill her! It's like she's under constant death threats, has to live in London, has 24-hour security. They've already tried to kill her. You know, they've already shot her in the face. I mean, it's already a big deal. And all she's basically saying is girls should have an education. And she's not even saying that they shouldn't have a religious education. She's not even saying that, where it should be like a completely secular education. So do you see this as kind of a little depressing, where it's like even somebody that most people think of as a revolutionary is very mildest of baby steps?
It is. We've kind of talked about this off air. But, you know, I mean, it's something. That's how I look at it. Like,
right.
And I didn't go as far as saying Islam needs to be wiped out, but I was saying that Islam needs their reformation that Christianity went through. They need that great awakening with them and for moderates to take back the religion. And, I mean, if this is a step in that direction, then good for them. But, I mean, taking these small steps, like, if that's what it takes, then, you know, I'm for it. But, yeah, it is kind of depressing that, you know, how small of a step that it's going to take to actually get something done. And even this is meeting with so much resistance.
Yeah, and in the movie, they interview all these people in Pakistan. They go, what do you think about Malala? And they're like, oh, well, she lives in London saying all this. She needs to come here and say it. And I'm like, why? So you could try to kill her again? You've already tried to kill her. You've already shot her in the face. Like, their whole response is like, well, she's a puppet of the West, and she needs to come here and say all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you saw how dangerous that was. Like, she lasts maybe a week if she really came back and did that. It's a canard. I mean, I feel like even in the basic freedoms are pretty much non-existent, and somebody has to live somewhere else and say that, even like you're saying, where they were so down on her and so negative about her. And to us, I mean, she's, I guess in the Muslim world, very far liberal, but I'm not even sure she'd be a moderate in America. And everybody's got their own idea of what a revolution is. And I think that, I don't know, it's just sort of so, in the Islamic world, and especially when it comes to Mali, it's so mild that it almost looks like there's no way you could get the job. The debate is not where that debate is. Our debate is like, how do they get women to vote? And their debate is like, how can they go to school past eighth grade and not have the school burned down with women? How do they, you know, like the debates are so far apart, they're not quite where they need to be. It did get me thinking about the sacred cows that are left and what we could slaughter. One thing I've wanted to talk about for a long time is this idea that third parties would save us. It's kind of the ultimate romantic delusion. Probably 5 times in my lifetime, now's the moment for a third party. And I'm sure they've been saying that for probably since the 1800s. They've been saying, like, now's the time for a third party. They've probably been saying that for, I mean, since there were Whigs and Tories, right? And then usually what happens is there is a third party for about one election cycle, and then it just becomes the new Whigs or the new Tories. I mean, they're set up to favor a two-party system. Andrew Jackson only started the Democratic Party because he didn't get one of the others. So I'm sure if you had, I mean, if they denied him the Republican nomination and he went out and started the Bull Moose Party 2.0, that would probably just become the new Republican Party. They'd be like, you know what?
Yeah.
Bull Moose is a hell of a lot better than an elephant. I think we'll take that. And they would just go twist it around and change it. When it comes to third parties, I mean, what have you heard?
I haven't really heard a lot of people calling for a third party.
Oh, I hear it a lot. They always think that's going to be the answer. Like, the Democrats are corrupt, the Republicans are corrupt. And I think if they brought in the third party, it just, you'd have three corrupt parties. All this stuff that they think a third party is going to be, I'm like, if they really get going and really get powerful, wouldn't that just be a third corrupt party? Wouldn't it just be exactly the same as...
Yeah, exactly. I think the thing that I'm hearing the most, it's not really calling for a third party. I hear people talking about like getting rid of parties and just saying having everybody be completely independent because parties are corrupt. And the people make up the party. So you're not doing anything to stop the corruption. You know?
Right, I mean, right.
If you think Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are both corrupt, getting rid of parties isn't going to stop them from being corrupt, if that's your belief.
Like, Trump is a good example of somebody who barely fits in a political party anyway, because first he was a Democrat, now he's a Republican. If the Republicans had denied him the nomination, he probably could have been a third-party candidate.
Yeah.
And so you're already talking about somebody who transcends ideology. And he's the most hated presidential candidate. So they showed his unfavorable rating. Right now, I can't really believe this is true, but apparently Hillary has the second highest unfavorability rating of any presidential candidate. I'm a little surprised, but Trump has the highest unfavorability rating of any presidential candidate that's ever run. And he's already somebody that kind of transcends political parties. I think that's what I kind of believe, is that the people who really, like whenever we talk about third parties, somebody like Gary Johnson as a libertarian, or somebody like Jill Stein as Green Party, people like them until they actually win, and then they hate them worse than anybody. Our political system, it's already too ideologically driven in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, people like the idea of the third party because they like the idea of moderate who doesn't really have a party, and they go in there and get things done, and that's not usually what you see in an actual third party. It's somebody who's even more ideologically driven and even more ideologically pure, and then they don't get shit done the whole time they're in Congress. It's never really gone anywhere. Because of that, like, if you really had Gary Johnson as president or Jill Stein as president, that'd be terrible, because they don't really know what to... If Ron Paul had really ran as a libertarian and won, after 4 years, everybody would be like, this is the worst president we've ever had. I mean, he sucks.
Yeah.
The political party system, I understand that sometimes it's hard to defend, but the political party system, people say, this is what's keeping the status quo in place. And I'm like, well, it's also keeping us from an outright disaster. We can't have President Ron Paul. And I'm like, maybe it's set up to save you from yourselves. Maybe if you had President Ron Paul, you'd see what a fucking disaster that would be if you got what you wanted, which you think you won't. Kind of what got me thinking about this idea of revolutions and third parties. I met an actual Trump fan. I did some extra work on a TV show. I live in Los Angeles. I mentioned that a couple times. I've not actually met a single Trump fan in Los Angeles. I don't see stickers for him. I don't see billboards for him. And I probably won't, quite frankly. Like, I think if you had a Trump yard sign, your house would get egged. Like, he's pretty unpopular in L.A. I could just imagine. I mean, it would almost be a fun exercise to take a Trump sticker and put on the back of my bumper and then just go riding around Long Beach, or like, you know, hey guys, how's it going? Like, honk the horn and just go driving around all day. I'd probably get the finger a lot of time. But this guy was the Trump fan in Los Angeles. You know, he's like 70 years old, but he was an extra on a TV show set, which surprised me even more that he felt so comfortable. I mean, it's Hollywood. You wouldn't think you'd meet that many Trump people, quite frankly, and you probably won't, but the fact that he was an extra and he was on set, and there were 10 other extras around him who pretty much did not agree with what he was saying, and he still felt emboldened enough. But what he was basically saying was, well, Trump's going to create a revolution. Trump's going to give us a revolution, and somebody's like, he's going to create a world war. He goes, that could happen. That could happen. With Trump, there's no middle ground. Either you're going to have a political revolution, or you're going to have World War III. Yeah, that ain't a risk I'm willing to take. Like, just fast is going to be ashes, a 50-50 shot. That's not a good dice throw to me. And I even asked him, I said, in that scenario you just laid out, political revolution's the best possible outcome. What is that to you, and what does that mean? And, like, what do you think would happen? It got so vague, it was hard to... Well, Hillary Clinton is part of the status quo, and she's just trying to keep everything in place and all this stuff. And with Trump, he's going to flip the table, man. He's going to create a political revolution. And he kept saying that. And it reminded me of the Bernie people. I kind of understood what they meant. They kind of meant more like a socialist revolution. Bernie's going to go after the corporate people, the oligarchs, and redistribute some of the wealth, maybe have free education. I kind of got a sense of what they meant. When the Trump people talked about a revolution, it's a lot vaguer. Like, I'm not even sure what they really want to happen.
I don't think they really know what they want to happen. They just want Trump to win.
Yeah. Go back to that $1 million question of why.
Well, they want America to...
He didn't use any of Trump's rhetoric, but he just said that he liked him because he's different and he's going to create a revolution. And I kept trying to nail down, what are you talking about? Like, what does that mean to you? And I got the sense, like you said, I don't know that he really knew what he meant. I just think he thinks that something would be different if Trump, like, it would be so different. And he's probably right. It was just interesting because this guy was older. He's talking about we might have World War III. That'd be okay with me. Yeah, he's 70. Who gives a fuck if there's World War III if you're that older? But I have a 3-year-old son. I can't just roll the dice and be like, well, my son has no future. It was worth it. It doesn't sound like he's got kids, or at least if he does, it doesn't sound like he's very close to them. Just from what he was saying, it sounded like he might be estranged from them. He's probably pretty poor because extras don't get paid that much. I mean, nobody's really out there making that much money. I started to get a sense of a Trump voter, or at least a Trump voter in terms of revolution. Somebody whose life, like, it's not gone the right way, and something radical would have to happen, like something major would have to change. To them, it's worth it to roll the dice on a trigger-happy madman who might start a nuclear war, because to them, that might be the only way things can really change for them. Incremental change is not going to do it when you're 70 years old and poor. Like, I think he's probably thinking, like, something big has got to go down. And that'll be the only way that things can change for me.
Yeah.
The Trump people that I come into contact with, all they ever want to talk about is Hillary being corrupt and Donald Trump's going to fix stuff. He's going to fix our immigration problem. He's going to fix everything. They don't really know what they're talking about. They say Hillary's corrupt, so we can't have her. And Donald Trump is going to fix stuff. And he's going to stop all problem with all of our immigrant coming in. Like, that's it. Like, that's all they want to talk about is immigration. Which, I mean, I guess, granted, the place that I live, it, a lot of people look at that as a big issue, which we've talked about in past episodes, but that's all they want to talk about. And it's like, you don't understand what you're saying. And I don't think you understand Donald Trump as a candidate. Nobody understands Donald Trump as a candidate. Like, you don't know what he's going to do. He literally sent out a tweet, like, about the liberal media, like, trying to understand me. Like, his actual tweet, like, I don't know why the liberal media says they're trying to understand me. They'll never do so. Like, I don't think saying that people can't understand you when you're running for president is a...
Right. Sometimes Trump has like a pathos and a self-pity that is truly disgusting, because he's talking about himself like he's a 13-year-old girl in his diary. Nobody gets me. They don't understand me. They don't know what I'm going through. It just goes back to what I think of Trump, which is that it's all about him. Nobody's pain is as great as his pain. There's like a self-pitying quality to him that is kind of like, you're asking us to feel sorry for you? It's kind of outrageous. I think that's kind of the downfall of Trump in this general election cycle, is that he lost his confidence.
Yeah.
Because people respond to confidence. It's why women date jerks. You see a woman, she'll be like, I don't even know why I dated that guy. If somebody walks into a room, women can do it too, right? Anybody can do it. If you walk into a room like you own it, and somebody's very confident, it's intoxicating, because their confidence kind of becomes contagious in that way. People like being around confident people, and Trump's always using the term winner, winner, winner. Right in the back of your mind, you start thinking, well, if he likes me, I'll be a winner. His winning is my winning. And when people are talking about winners and losers, Trump, he's always kind of getting these verbal divisions where women are either tens or they're ugly or they're fat pigs. There's the social aspect that we want to be considered a 10. We want to be considered a winner. We don't want him to put us in the category of loser. People get that when they're in grade school. And so I think in Trump's case, that was what made him so intoxicating in the primaries, and it's what's made him bottom out in the general, is that after he won the nomination, it's kind of like he lost his confidence, and he started kind of going into self-pitying, poor me, nobody gets me mode. His core fans, that plays well with them, because in their mind, he can't get a break. So what he's saying, like, I can't get a break, the media doesn't treat me fairly. He gets the people he's always had, but he can't grow his base that way, because moderates are like, yeah, you feel like a loser to me. I'm going to go with the person I think is going to win.
Yeah, and that's what everybody was saying about how if Trump doesn't change, winning in a Republican primary is one thing, but the message that you have in a Republican primary never translates over to a general election. And he thought that he could just continue being Trump, and in a general election, people would just buy into that like the Republican primary, and that didn't happen.
Last week, we talked a little bit about, I don't think Islamophobia is real. Like, I think it's like, it's an ideology. You can't really treat that the way you do racism. But when he started going after that Gold Star family, the Muslim family that went to the DNC, and they talked about their son getting killed, and he started like calling them Muslim Brotherhood. They polled it that 2/3 of Republicans didn't like that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was amazing. Like, I mean, I expected Democrats to hate it. I expected even moderates and independents to hate it. But 2/3 of Republicans thought he was wrong. to do that and go after them in that way. I think it's very interesting that you have a candidate that can make Republicans side with a Muslim family. It's just pretty unusual that, like, I mean, if Trump keeps talking, you're going to have Republicans be like, you know what, let's be friends with Iran. What have we got to lose? It always reminds me of what I think, which is that American politics is not an action, but a reaction. And it's just you pushing people one way or another. Like, to me, I kind of like underdogs. And if we lived in a country where it was like every single day, all of the TV networks were like, Muslims are bad, Muslims are bad, Muslims are bad, I would start thinking, no, they're not that bad. And if you live in a country that's like every single day, nothing's going on, nothing's going on, nothing's going on, I start thinking something's going on. But like for me, I kind of go the opposite, where I want to take like the devil's argument or the play devil's advocate a little bit. And I think that that's why when people talk about a political revolution, it only kind of seems appealing because it seems unlikely. Like, I think it's one of those romantic notions that's like, Bernie is a perfect candidate because he's not a real candidate. Like, he's not really going to be president, but he's a perfect candidate. Like, he can be romantic, an ideal. I mean, he can make you feel great or whatever, and it's only because he's never going to win that, like, you can look at him and be like, oh my God, only he could win. If only we could get what he's talking about. That's the whole appeal. If he really won and became president and was the most impotent president since Jimmy Carter, probably even worse than that, the appeal would be shattered.
Yeah.
The worst thing that could happen to Bernie is becoming president, quite frankly. It's just a lot more appealing to think about what could have been. You know, you hear people be like, oh, if only JFK had lived, and I think he should have lived. I don't think he should have been assassinated, but if he hadn't been assassinated, I don't even know that we would talk about JFK. Like, I don't even know that we would think about it. Same thing with Abraham Lincoln. If he hadn't been assassinated, I don't even know that, like, we would even think about him as the greatest president. When you have, like, something deferred or something doesn't happen or whatever, it's easy to romanticize what that could have been. People like the Clintons and Obama, they have a much harder job because they have to, like, actually do the work. We've gone from one potential revolution to another. First, you had the Reagan Revolution.
Yeah.
So we were born kind of at the end of the Reagan Revolution. Then Bill Clinton came in with the New Deal Democrats. And the third way Democrats were supposed to be a revolution of sorts, because the old Democrats, they couldn't win, they couldn't do anything. So he was a revolution of a sorts of what they had at that time period. And now, of course, what he did in 92, which was a revolution for that time period, that looks like the most stale thing in the world. Like, that looks like the ultimate sellout move. So then you had George W. Bush come in with kind of the evangelical revolution, because even though Reagan created the evangelical base, George W. really capitalized on that. And then you had 2008, Obama come in with the Obama revolution. It amazes me, we're talking about Bernie's revolution, Trump's revolution. The first black president, that was a revolution. Everybody thought that was going to change things. They're like, oh, I heard that argument against Hillary in 2008. If Hillary wins, it'll be the status quo. Obama's the one going to bring revolution, man. You know, like, he's the one who's going to really flip the apple cart. They can't stand it if a guy like that wins. 2 years into his term, oh, he's just the same old thing. It's amazing how quickly people became jaded to that. Hillary's the first female president, but nobody even really talks about that as a revolution. I don't hear anybody call it a feminist revolution, which it could be considered that, and I don't hear anybody say that.
Right. Democratic Party tried to play it up as such. The DNC, when they had all the you know, female congresswomen coming up on stage and saying positive things about Hillary, but you don't really, just in everyday conversation, you don't hear that being brought up.
No.
I actually was having a conversation with a young woman. I mean, she was, I don't know, 25, 26 years old, and she was like, I don't think a woman needs to be president. Like, I don't think that's a positive thing for women. And I'm like, what?
Right. What's the reasoning behind that? I mean, what?
She basically was saying that women are too emotional for the job. And I'm like, I could see sitting in a bar with like a bunch of like bikers or something saying this. This is coming from a millennial.
This is probably what she really believes, because there's no reason that you don't even agree with her. So there's really no reason to say that.
I know. Like, unless we're having a conversation, and I'm the one supporting a female president.
So I've had that same feeling. And now, again, you know, vast majority of women support Hillary. I mean, she has really good numbers with women. There's a perception out there that she doesn't have female support, which is wrong. She does have female support. But I've had that same feeling where there was somebody that was definitely like that category, sort of a conservative category, but they're basically saying what you're saying. But they were in the Bernie category of being like, well, Hillary's the same old shit. Nothing's going to change. Bernie's going to be radical revolution. Bernie's going to be better for me than Hillary ever could be. The Hollywood actor Mark Ruffalo, who is pretty liberal or whatever, but he's like, I'm backing Bernie for my daughters, and I thought, why? So you can say that a man can come save you, you know? Like, it seemed like an odd putting Bernie for my daughters. I was like, that seems like a crock of shit. Let's run through it. So there's the Bernie Revolution, which I think people consider that a socialist revolution. There's the Trump Revolution, which God only knows what that even. The Trump Revolution is a fucking crazy train mix of, like, white nationalism and, like, anti- I don't even know what that revolution really is. I mean, people, when they talk about Trumpism, I mean, it's hard to really even say what that is. The Obama Revolution, which I think, I like Obama a lot, but I think even his biggest fans would say was not really a revolution. I mean, it kind of, better version of what we had. In 2008, Obama inherited a dumpster fire from George W. Bush, a terrible economy. He fixed it. He fixed a lot of problems we had. People wanted him to be something that he never said he would be. I think Obama came in and said, I'm a center-left Democrat. I'm here to fix your problems. And then white liberals heard, right on, brother. The Black Panthers are here, and we're taking these home. You know, like, they just went into this mindset of shit he never said. I remember there was, like, some white liberal, somebody I literally wasn't that familiar with, probably was a big deal in the 60s, and they go, Obama's such a letdown. He let us down. And I go, he didn't promise you shit. What do you mean he let you down? He never said, I'm going to realize the dream of the 60s radical. All the dreams you had in 1969, I'm going to make those a reality. I'm here for you, aging white baby boomer liberals. I'm here to spell out your life choices. He never promised them that.
Yeah.
I think they projected that onto him. And then when it became like, oh no, he actually wants to be a great president, so people can look back and say the first black president was also a great president. I think that distorted their dream somehow. Like, that kind of twisted it into something of like, oh, he's just another politician. That's what he said he was. He said he wanted to be a great president. He didn't want to validate your life choices from 50 years ago. I think Bernie's the only politician who's really promised an open revolution, because he's lost in that mindset of the aging 60s radical. That's why those people love him so much. That's why they get attached to him so much. I think Trump, one day he's Mr. Status Quo, the next day he's promising a revolution, the next day he's respectable Trump. Every time he has to be respectable Trump, it looks like a kid trying on his dad's suit or something, you know? He's got to put on his dad's tie and make a face in the mirror, and he's like, yeah, I can sit through this boring speech and not make a fart noise or something.
It was so funny because he was given his first official speech after his third or fourth campaign shakeup or whatever, and like he's going into it, he's being real calm, real trying to be professional about it, and his fans are going crazy. He says something about immigration, and they start chanting, build that wall, build that wall. He kind of like waves his hand out on him. He's like, we will build that wall.
I could just see it, like, he has dramatic music playing in the background or something, and it's like they're swelling up, and then he goes, what if he started giving, like, a Coach Taylor speech from Friday Night Lights or something, and then his eyes are watering up, and then they sue him for copyright infringement. Have you seen where, like, Trump keeps playing music, and all these artists keep saying, please, God, don't play my music at your rallies, but they keep trying to get him not to play their songs, and then he just refuses to. He, like, plays what he wants to play anyway, and has his playlist. And then there's a feminist revolution, and the feminist revolution started, it's really been going on a long time. People think of it as starting in the 60s, but I think the women's suffrage movement back in the 20s would probably say, no, it's been around longer than that. I think these things have always kind of been going on, and that's what I think is the ultimate sacred cow that we can't address, which is when people are talking about all of these issues right now, none of these issues are new. And so you could almost kind of say the ultimate sacred cow is the idea that, like, anything changes. I started reading the John Updike Quartet Rabbit Run, the series about Rabbit Angstrom, and I mean, I'm reading a book set in 1969. He wrote it in 1969, and it's set in 1969, and they're talking about black radicals and everything's gone crazy, and white cops are shooting them, and they're shooting cops. This is 1969. And we're in 2016, and it's like, I mean, it's a version of that, and we don't even have it as bad as they did. In 69, it was way worse than it is right now, but it's a version of that. Everything's a version of that. What Bernie's promising is a version of that. What Trump's promising is an echo of George Wallace, if you think about it. And what George Wallace promised was an echo of Andrew Jackson and Polk and all these presidents who wanted to take Mexico, and they wanted to get Mexicans out of Texas and stuff like that. I mean, all this stuff has been going on forever. What Hillary's doing right now, the feminist revolution started in the 1920s, and it was started even before that, where you had women in the Victorian era that didn't want to just be like breeding horses. They wanted a life. They wanted to do other stuff. They wanted creative artistic endeavors and fulfillment and things. You can't read an Edith Wharton accountable and not see shadows of that in the struggles that we go through today with Hillary and stuff like that. So these are just echoes and echoes that have been going on forever. I guess that's why I'm a little skeptical of like the revolution, because we lived through just hundreds of them. I know some about history, but you're a real history buff. I mean, can you see anything really changing through revolution since we've had so many that have been promised? Or are we just kind of going to live out echoes of the past?
That's a good question. I think with America, I don't think you're going to see some type of revolution that's going to truly, like, as far as political, I don't think you're going to have anything really political that's going to completely change the status quo. I think you'll have gradual change, but I don't think you're going to have one big revolution that's going to come in and just completely turn the country upside down. I think you have that with other aspects within the country, such as, you know, technologically, militarily, those types of revolutions, yeah. But as far as political revolution, I just can't see it happening. We have no precedent of it happening, really. Probably the biggest, what you could call a revolution of our lifetime, was the Reagan Revolution. And
even that was just a return to stuff that had already happened. Like, that was just kind of, the Reagan Revolution was just trying to get rid of all the progress that had happened in the 60s and 70s. It was just trying to return you to, I won't even call it Eisenhower's America, because Eisenhower's America was a lot better for the middle class than Reagan's America. It was like Republicans had been trying to live in a version of the 1950s that has none of that economic progress. Like, it's basically socially the 1950s, but economically it's the 1930s that they really want to go back to. Early 1930s, late 1920s.
Hoover's America.
America to be Hooverville, which is funny because, learn about history and stuff, a lot of Republicans didn't even like Eisenhower. They thought he was a communist because of some of the social programs that he did. When I hear Bernie's vision of America, he's not really talking about the 70s. People think about the 70s radicalism. He's really talking about the 50s, ironically enough. And it's only because of the way that the political parties are right now that you can't praise the 1950s, even though that was by far the best period for the middle class. You had sort of bipartisan progress. Like, the reason that America grew and grew was FDR and Eisenhower and LBJ. They were two Democrats and one Republican, but they weren't too far apart on economic issues. They somewhat overlapped just a little bit, just enough to where you could get a broad consensus of, here's how we have the biggest middle class in the world, here's how we keep going economically. And I think the problem has come from some of the revolutions we've seen since that time period in terms of economics. When we hear people talk about economics on the conservative side, I've said before that, like, the conservatives, social conservatives haven't changed. What social conservatives want right now is what they wanted for 100 years. They haven't changed not wanting abortion and not wanting gay marriage, basically trying to limit any type of social interference in the way, in the status quo or whatever. They haven't changed. People talk about them more now. It's the fiscal conservatives that have gone off the fucking deep end. Like, it's them that have really changed. Because, I mean, right now, to have major presidential candidates talking about the top 1% pays no income taxes, I couldn't imagine somebody saying that in the 50s and not being like, they would have been like, no, you're not going to win. You're done. Yeah. And I think that's what's changed. I think the real revolution took place in the middle class. You started to have people that, middle class became a bad thing. Like, it started to kind of warp around your perceptions to where everybody wanted to be. Reagan was an evil genius. Reagan is the person that really started to fuck up America. People talk about him like he was this great president. Republicans always talk about him. He's the one who really started changing things. He had kind of this mix of, like, Big Brother, George Orwell, and then optimism. So he could mix this stuff together and make you optimistic about the fact you were losing your benefits, optimistic about the fact he was breaking up unions. He could make you feel good about that. But he was telling you don't have to worry about the middle class advantages anymore. You're going to be rich, so you don't have to worry about any of that shit anymore. And that was the lie they sold to people, was being middle class is bad. You shouldn't even want to be that. You should want to be rich. So what do you care if we break up the union? What do you care if we cut your benefits? What do we care if we cut your wages? You're a year away from hitting it big time, buddy. And I think that that was sold to Gen X, and it was especially sold to the millennials, so we didn't notice that not only were we not becoming richer, we were really becoming poorer. Yeah. Like, not only were we not the 1%, we weren't even middle class anymore. We slid into the lower class. A lot of what Bernie says is actually not wrong, is because he's getting at that pre-Reagan 1950s period, really pre-Nixon period as well. And he's kind of getting into that heart of, when I go out in Los Angeles and I'm walking down the street, every fifth car is an Uber driver. I see that damn Uber sticker on, like, every fifth car. And half these people don't even have people in the back seat. It's just that they're so desperate and they're so broke and people can't make ends meet. Nobody wakes up when they're, But you know what I need to do? I need to let strangers sit in the back of my car and drive them around and not get paid a decent taxi cab driver salary. And if I have wear and tear on my car and my car breaks down, I pay for that. And if anything bad happens in my car, I pay for that. If I have a wreck, I pay for that. If one of them dies in the back seat, I'm responsible. The contractor economy is really what's killing the American dream. And because you're seeing companies try to get around, like paying full benefits, try to get around any kind of protections, we need that. We need a new protection against the contractor economy, because all the laws that were passed in the 50s and 60s to protect full-time workers and all that stuff, none of that applies in the contractor economy. And that's why people are going through it. It's a new way around it. That's the revolution we should be talking about, is how to stop this circumventing of the middle class and cutting down wages and stuff. You know, in a weird way, everybody's got a way to save the middle class except stuff that would really save the middle class. Bernie talked about TPP and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and they talked a little bit about raising minimum wage, which is still, that's still the floor. And by the way, minimum wage doesn't apply to Uber drivers. They might make less than that anyway. It doesn't apply to contractors and people like that. They might not make that anyway. You saw, like, minimum wage and TPP out of Democrats, out of Republicans, you heard, oh, illegal immigrants, billionaires pay too many taxes. Everybody's got a solution except for what most people are really going through. I don't know if I'd say I want a political revolution. I don't know if America needs a political revolution. I think we need something that acknowledges where the economy is now, where we live now, and we're not getting that. We're getting a lot of, like, 1930s and 50s and 70s solutions that don't really, they're not really addressing, like, the contractor economy and where the middle class is now and what can be, like, the laws do have to change. I mean, you could easily pass laws that would stop contract employees from being worse than regular employees. And then that would cut down on the need for contract employees. That would cut down on temporary people. If the Uber drivers had the exact same protections and exact same benefits and wages and all that stuff that taxi cab drivers did, you wouldn't see every fifth car on the road being an Uber driver. They'd have to cut back. But, I mean, you'd see the people who still did it would make more money. I took an Uber one time, and the guy driving it, I said, how much, you know, how much do you make an hour? He goes, sometimes it's like $5. If it was any job, I mean, if he went to go work at, like, CVS Pharmacy or something, they couldn't pay him $5 an hour. He'd have to make more than that. They gave people the illusion that, like, oh, it's temporary. It's something you can do in the meantime. You've got freedom. You've got freedom. I can't think of less freedom than driving around the streets to pick up strangers, to put them in the back seat of my car, and them telling me where to drive me, and using my own gas, my own wear and tear, my own wheels, if some wheel blows up. That is the opposite of freedom. Oh, you can have freedom. You can do Airbnb. You can rent your apartment out to strangers. I can't think of less freedom than having some fucking hipster asshole come in my apartment in Los Angeles, use my shower, sleep in my bed, get their fucking pubic hair on the soap, and sit on the shower drain, and then file a complaint. One star. This house didn't have enough air conditioning. I can't think of less freedom than that. But that's enough. They're taking everything I own. You can rent your clothes out through certain websites. You rent your clothes, your car, your residence. What's next? Sleepwithmywife.com. And then they give her like 1.5 stars. She didn't have enough practice. To me, they're taking everything you've got. But they've sold this as, here's your freedom. Here's your ticket. And so I think for there to be any real meaningful revolution, people would have to know what the damn problem is, which I don't think enough people do right now.
They like to think they do, but like you're saying, no, there's so much wrong that it looked over, basically in the name of, I mean, I hate to say it, but in the name of capitalism. I mean, it's all about how can we make the biggest profit?
Well, I don't even think we have capitalism right now. Like, people always say, well, socialism, the answer to the problem is capitalism. I don't even think we've got capitalism. Capitalism means I pay you what you're worth. And right now, they say, well, you get paid what the market demands. And I'm like, well, if the market has driven has made jobs into nonprofit hobbies, which is what a lot of jobs are right now. They're hobbies. They're unpaid hobbies is what a lot of jobs have become. In my own experience, like just graduating from college and everything, get a job, and I've tried to work on Wall Street. I've tried to get a job in the media. I've tried to get a job as a journalist. Every job right now, the first year, unpaid internship. Mm-hmm. Used to be you would do that shit in college, right?
Yeah.
Now you get an unpaid internship. Wall Street, you want to go work at Goldman Sachs? Okay, you got to do a 6-month unpaid internship. You want to go to work at Warner Brothers? Same thing. You want to go to work at the New York Times? Same thing. You want to go to work at a PR firm? Every job just about. In the literary world, the people that work at the publishing houses or whatever, 6-month unpaid internship, and people do it thinking, well, I'll do it, and then I can get my manuscript published after that internship's over with. No, you leave, and then somebody else comes in for their unpaid internship. People are using unpaid interns as secretaries, which is what they're doing, and that's a job that's lost because every 6 months they just change out the internship. and somebody else comes in and does it, and they never get anywhere doing it. Bernie addressed that a little bit, but I never heard him say, well, what we really need to do is make sure interns get paid. Unless they're getting college credit, interns need to get paid for their services, which would be great. It needs to happen.
Yeah, definitely needs to.
Speak from experience, I mean, working in New York, I mean, first they wanted an unpaid internship. When that finished, I was like, all right, how about a job or whatever like that? And then it was like, oh, we're just going to get another intern. Then you're like, oh, but this is good experience on your resume. You put your resume out there, and they'll be like, yeah, this is good experience, but, you know, we have our own internship program. So they wanted you to do back-to-back internships, and then every job you would see, you'd be like, you need to have 3 years experience, which is great until you realize, how do you get 3 years experience if nobody will hire you in the first place? And then you think, oh, well, this internship will be experience you use towards that. No, they want 3 years work experience, which you can't get because you had internships that don't count as work experience. And it was all this, it was basically like the catch-22 shell game, vicious cycle of poverty, basically. And I'm like, I've been working for 2 years. Can I fucking see a single paycheck out of this? Can we see, like, any, like, actual ink on a check? Because this is the kind of stuff people used to get paid to do. I mean, it would have been outrageous if you just said, oh, you just got out of college, your last semester was an internship, let's follow that up with another year's unpaid internship. You would have never seen that before.
Right.
People say, oh, you know how it is? You start out in the mailroom and you work your way up to executive level. I bet it's been a long time since that really happened.
Right.
I think it's been, you start out now in the mailroom and you start out at poverty wages and then you stay in the mailroom for 3 years and when you say, hey, how about a promotion? Oh, you're tired of the mailroom? We got a whole stack of interns over there that want to be in the mailroom. You know, that's what they put over there. I graduated in kind of right at the beginning of the crash, like 2008, right during the Bush years, and I can remember showing up at job fairs and there would be a line around the door for people that were in the job with me to interview at Verizon, to sling phones at Verizon, and the guy in front of me used to be like a manager of a Burger King. I mean, he had like 20 years work experience.
Yeah.
I'd say something like, I'm 21 and he's 50 and he's got like 30 years work experience. Hey, you want to buy a smartphone? You know, I mean, like, it just seemed, it kind of fucked up millennials. And I think that that's why a lot of millennials and a lot of young people younger than that really gravitated towards Bernie, because he was promising a way out of it, like a way out of this vicious cycle. But a lot of his solutions, like free college and stuff, that really only helps people who have not already gone through college.
Right.
And so with a lot of people like that are 30 or like in between 21 and 35, basically, it's like, what do they do? And what are their answers and what are their choices? Which is why I think some of those people, not a lot of them, but some of them people went over to Trump. Because at least with Trump over there promising nuclear war, it's like, hey, all the Nazis had jobs. Like, here's America. Hey, we're all soldiers, you know, and all this stuff. So Trump's over there like, hey, I need to hire 1 million people to guard the border and kill Mexicans. Hey, there's a job. And so, I mean, people are just, they just going anywhere that Trump, he'll be like, I'll take you from soup lines to steak lines. How? Let me first, and we'll get around to that or whatever. So I can see the appeal of these revolutions.
Yeah.
It's a funny time that we live in. It kind of reminds me of A Tale of Two Cities. It's the best of times and the worst of times. In a way, I think there's never been a better time to be alive than 2016. I really believe that. I think it's an amazing time period. But all of the advantages that come with living in 2016, they're very flashy, and they're right out on the surface, but the disadvantages are more subtle, so that it can kind of be like, you don't really see that you're losing all your benefits. You're getting paid less than your parents made. You may never have Social Security. You have $100,000 in student loan debt and all this stuff. People that are millennials, they're moving out at much later rates. I mean, people used to move out right out of college. Now they're staying at home until they're 30, 35, 40. And it's debt in a lot of this stuff that's coming. So I think it's the best times, it's the worst of times. I really would never rather be alive than right now, but I can see where the disadvantages are insidious. It's almost like gas. It just comes in and you don't even know that it's happening until, you know, it's a little bit harder to really put your finger on, really. Some people, you talk about a political revolution, and they're just like, yeah, that's crazy talk. And then some people are like, right on, right on. And they'll be like, oh, how about a socialist one? Sure. How about Trump's nationalist Aryan rally? Okay, whatever. You know, they just go and work. They just go wherever there's change, because they feel a little hopeless. They feel a little locked out of the progress that's happening. And even if there's a third party, because we've seen Pat Buchanan, Ross Perot, we've seen Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, Ralph Nader. I mean, we've seen third party after third party. It always winds up the same. You start out with a vain old man, mostly an old man, every once in a while an old woman, but 95% of the time an old man that can save you and they can deliver something else, and it's all the same. They never win, and if they ever did win, they would be so much like Democrats. You'd be like, why didn't I just vote for a liberal liberal Democrat, you wind up in the same place. You went around the world to get to the same place. Do you think America, well, you know, final question in note, I mean, does America really need a revolution? And do we really need third parties, political parties?
No, I'll sum that up easily.
No, I was expecting your master thesis. You were going to be like, here's my Atticus Finch moment. I'm going to lay this on the courtroom and be like, here's why you're wrong. And, you know, go into this thing, political revolution. I mean, where would it wind up?
I don't feel like it will wind up anywhere. I don't feel like a political revolution is going to really change anything with America right now.
You can almost see, like, a political revolution talk. That's almost like an American privilege, because we talk about, like in other countries, when we talk about, oh, Iran's having a revolution right now, it's like, oh, shit, you know? Cuba's having a revolution. Oh, no, you know? In other countries, when they have a revolution, that means, like, a violent coup followed by a civil war. And in America, we're talking about revolution. Bernie's eating a fucking turkey sandwich. Yeah, we're going to have a revolution. It's going to be pretty good. It's going to, you know, like, I mean, we're over there talking about, like, revolution the way that people talk about ordering tea or something. And then in other countries, when they have a revolution, no, it's like tanks on the street. I mean, it's like a revolution, you know? So, I think even talking about this in such cavalier terms, and like it would just definitely be a good thing that would help us. I mean, that's an American privilege. The fact that we don't even see a political revolution as a threat necessarily.
That's true. Yeah, that's definitely true.
I could just see Trump being like, hey, you guys asked for a revolution. We got one. And you see a damn tank going down Main Street or something. Like there's a military helicopter flying over Hollywood Boulevard. He's like, oh yeah, Bill Maher, you don't like me? Get out of your fucking house. You know, and they'd be like, oh wait. A real revolution. Shit. Back up. The more I study about the late 1960s period, where literally some of the black community and the police departments were in an almost civil war, and you were seeing the police shootings we have today, they are horrible, but in the 60s they were every day, and a lot of the militant groups went back at it. I mean, they were having, I think in the 60s it was a lot worse period than we're in right now. But people forget. They get so old and they forget. And so when people's like, any change and any violence and any political revolution going on TV, it seems like the end of the world, forgetting that like the late 60s and most of the 70s was 100 times worse. Because I've married to someone who's black, and I remember there was another black woman one time that said, yeah, I just don't know if I could be married to a white guy with everything that's going on in the world. And I'm like, what's going on in the world? And they're like, well, you know, all of the violence. And I'm like, and that's new, because like that's changed. In what way is that different? Or how is that different than like the Rodney King beatings in the 90s and when Oakland was on fire and all the way back to the 60s turmoil and Martin Luther King Jr. was killed? Now is the worst time period for this stuff. I don't see it that way. People have pretty much always been the same. I don't know that they can really even break out of these patterns, but I think, I said it before, I'll close in on this. When people talk about a third party, in a lot of ways, the Democrats are the third party they want. And it's the only thing really keeping us back is the fact that we own almost no square footage of America. I mean, look at a map, and here we are on episode 34, and two-thirds of the way through, two-thirds of state legislatures and governorships are controlled by Republicans. Let's work on that. If we want a revolution, let's get them gone first, and then see what really takes. At least give Democrats a chance to really rule and see what they would do, which we haven't had that in a long time. Because they've either been shut out of one branch of Congress or the Supreme Court or something. Let's see what would happen if they were really in charge before we start tearing everything down. Michael, what's your web address for us?
BlueInAlabama.com.
Of course, you can find me at Alabama Liberal. Join us next time. We'll be at Big Milestone 35, and then the entire month of September we have some really special episodes coming up. So stay with us until the end, folks. You made it this long, might as well ride out this journey with us.